This episode brought to you by Beta Brand, the San Francisco-based source for crowdfunded clothing you can visit in person the next time you're in San Francisco, or stop by anytime online to shop bestsellers like dress pant yoga pants and now yoga jeans. And when you do, use the code SPIRIT20 to save 20% off anything on the site. But that's not the only reason we love Beta Brand. Oh no, our fandom does not stop at stretchy pants we can wear all day, no matter where we are. There are a great many other things you can do on the site, which is BETABRAND.com. Among them, you can use their Model Citizen tool to upload your own photo and then receive a custom link that makes it look like you are the main model on the homepage of their website. It's kind of a fun thing to share with family and friends on social media, leaving them to wonder whether they should congratulate you on your new and unexpected side gig or actually call your bluff. For you designers out there, you can submit your own ideas for new products and actually earn money when they become full-fledged Beta Brand products. And anyone, anytime, can visit the site to vote for the new designs that will become the next product sold on betabrand.com. And there's this: when you vote and a product ends up crowdfunded into production, you get a discount. And speaking of discounts, you can always save 20% when you shop the site with the code SPIRIT20. As regular listeners to the show know, we at Spirit of 608 appreciate Beta Brand's support, their support of female entrepreneurs and women building businesses in Fest. We're big fans of the company, what they do, and we think you will be too. So check them out at betabrand.com. This and every episode also brought to you with support from Prestope by the Spirit of 608. It's the new, affordable, interactive, and community-driven alternative to traditional PR and media relations built with care by us, especially for Fest brands. Visit the site to find out more about how we're able to bring our members one-on-one help and feedback from media experts, including direct answers to your questions, recommended daily media outreach tasks curated by us, especially with your business in mind, a DIY PR resource library, exclusive media ops, and connections with other Fest founders, plus much more, all for a monthly cost that's less than what a single hour of professional PR or media consulting would cost your brand. So check it out at prestope.com. That's PRESSDOPE.com. Spirit of 608, episode 95. You're listening to the Spirit of 608 podcast. I'm your host, Lorraine Sanders. Keep listening for stories, tips, and advice from women at the forefront of fashion, entrepreneurship, sustainability, and tech. I call it Fest, and it's the future. Hey, hey, and welcome to today's show. I'm excited to be able to bring the conversation that I have coming up on today's show to you. It's a good one, somebody that I have been wanting to have on the podcast for a really long time. She is truly a pioneer in the ethical fashion space, and I know you're going to get a lot out of listening to Rachel Fowler. She is the founder of Tonle, Cambodia's first zero-waste fashion brand. And when they say zero-waste, they mean zero waste. We're talking threads off of sewing machines are actually made into paper that the company uses for cards and other things that they do in their operations. You'll hear Rachel talk in depth about how they use every tiny little piece of fabric, scrap, and thread to create a truly zero waste apparel line in the conversation, as well as how she got into that. I mean, you don't just wake up one day and start a fashion brand that does things totally differently from basically every other fashion brand out there in the world. No, not surprisingly, it's something that takes years to build. And even more interestingly, perhaps, is the fact that Rachel didn't really set out to build this in the first place. She originally went to Cambodia to do research as the recipient of a Fulbright grant. And you know, One thing led to another. A project she began working on there turned into a business, turned into another year and another year and another year until she had taken the social justice mindset she had as a high school student and turned it into a business. One that today counts a team of 50 retail stockists in 10 countries, 4 of its own boutiques, and an international following. So get ready to hear from a really cool and down-to-earth founder who just recently relocated from Cambodia to the US. She's living in the San Francisco Bay Area. That's coming up in just a few minutes. Also in the San Francisco Bay Area, you will find, you guessed it, Beta Brand, our awesome show and episode sponsor. You can check them out in person in San Francisco's Mission District or shop them anytime online at betabrand.com. And when you do, don't forget to use the code SPIRIT20 to save 20% off anything on the site. Now, as you guys know, Beta Brand is near and dear to me every week because I bring them up on the show, but this week even more so because, yep, I'm getting a chance to use the romper that I was saying, you know, is a funny purchase for me because I'm not necessarily a romper girl. But as I'm recording this, I am prepping to head to Las Vegas for the annual Shop Talk conference, and it will be taking place when this airs. Or goes live. So that's where I am this week. And it's quite a nice contrast to what I've been experiencing in my life in Virginia. It is like 80 to 90 degrees every single day, which means I can finally wear my Beta Brand romper. So I'm going to be extremely excited to be able to actually do that. The thing, it's just, it has like the perfect cut and it's awesome. Now, I don't think rompers are exactly your typical conference attire, so I don't know exactly how I'm going to pull that off. But if you are looking for typical conference attire or something extremely appropriate for your next biz moment when you don't want to look super boring, let me recommend checking out their traveling Maryland dress. This thing is so cool, and I don't know, I might have to buy it, but I'm seriously trying not to buy anything right now because, you know, sometimes you have to just put the kibosh on the shopping. So this dress, though, it's, you know, what a temptress. It's black and made in a shirred polyester material that is wrinkle resistant, so you can pack it up. No one will ever know it was crunched in a tiny ball in the bottom of your suitcase. It has pockets, an elastic waist, and a V-neck. All things I absolutely love in a dress. And it totally goes from day to night. Yep. I'm obsessed. Okay. I'm gonna have to get off the site before I do something that I definitely don't want to do. Speaking of other things you don't want to do, you don't want to miss what's coming up in the outro today's show. That's the part we do after the interview proper. Stick around to hear some advice and tips inspired by my current conference experience that is taking place this week, including my top 2 tips for anybody attending a conference this year, tips that will help you make it worthwhile no matter what role you're playing, attendee, speaker, whatever it is, and how to get a deep dive on everything you need to know about public speaking in 10 minutes or less. That's coming up after the interview. As always, when you subscribe to the show in iTunes, leave a rating or review and tell your friends about us. It helps the show immensely, puts us into the ears of more people who believe in all of the good things happening at the intersection of fashion, entrepreneurship, sustainability, and tech. Now onto the conversation with Rachel Fowler, founder of Tonelay. Rachel, welcome to the Spirit of 608 podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have you on today. I have followed your brand for a long time, well, the last couple of years, and I am just so impressed with what you've done. And I was trying to think of an interesting metaphor before or analogy before talking to you. And I don't know why this is coming to mind because I'm not a rock climber, but it's sort of like, it seems to me kind of like a lot of people are interested in sustainable fashion. And if you were rock climbing, your brand would be the one that decided to do it without the ropes.
Wow, that's a really huge compliment because I'm actually a rock climber. And
are
that's,
you?
That's kind of nice.
I don't know why. That's so funny because I had no idea that you, I had no clue that you have any knowledge of that. But I was like, they've taken this to like this extreme level that is really, really cool and also seemingly really technically difficult. And so I'm excited to get into that in the conversation that we're going to have today.
Yeah. And I suppose too, that there's a high risk of failure. It's, but yeah, I mean, that's really nice. And, you know, it has been challenging to build a business this way, but it's incredibly rewarding in similar ways to the sport of rock climbing. So yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, so let's start off by telling people what Tonle does and how you are different from other ethical fashion brands that are out there in the world today.
Sure. So we're a zero waste fashion company. We produce everything in a workshop in Cambodia that operates under fair trade principles. So we really have a triple bottom line to our company where we're balancing everything we do with both environmental and social goals, as well as trying to become financially sustainable at the same time. So we use remnant materials from garment factories in Cambodia. There's a lot of waste in the fashion industry, and we try to produce beautiful, comfortable, casual, contemporary women's wear out of them. And at the same time, we use every single scrap in our production. So small scraps are actually turned into yarns and hand woven and knit into new fabrics. So we really have a holistic process, not only around how we design, but also how our workshops operate and how our whole business basically runs.
And I was looking at your site. You even take some of the yarns and put them into paper that becomes your tags.
Yeah. So we basically, the yarns are woven into new fabrics, but after we actually cut and sew products, there's even really small pieces of thread that come off the machines and things that we cannot make even into yarn that actually gets shredded up and turned into paper. And at the moment, we're using that paper to make mostly stationery cards and tags and things like that.
Okay. I want to get into the process and the materials and your company's unique approach to design and how you've built your brand. But I think it makes sense to go a little bit more into your background first, because you have a really interesting path to becoming a fashion business owner, and it's not like everybody's path. So I hope we can go there first.
That's fine. Yeah.
So I noticed on your LinkedIn profile, and I'm kind of obsessed with how people set up their LinkedIn profiles, because I feel like it's kind of a hard thing to do in a way that feels authentic and but is also professional. And you kick yours off by saying that you're an artist at heart and an entrepreneur by trade. And I just love that. How did you start out? Can you tell us a little bit about your artist background?
Yeah, so I have always considered myself an artist from when I was very young. People would ask me if I wanted to be an artist when I grew up, and I said, I already am an artist, as many children actually are. But so I had been interested in studying painting when I went to college, because I had been doing a lot of painting, but I'd always love textiles and fibers and fashion as well. I learned how to sew from my grandmother and my mother, and learned how to crochet from my aunt. And that had always been a part of my life since I was young. But in high school, I had a very strong sort of social justice mindset, and I could not see myself participating in the fashion industry because of what I already knew were rampant issues of exploitation, abuse, and as well as environmental problems. And so when I went to college, I initially started pursuing a degree in painting, but I still was so drawn to the textile department and ended up going into fine art major in fibers. And that, you know, I think it was the way that textiles around the world historically have been created by women. Generally, they are often created by people in groups, and they represent cultures and ideas rather than a sole individual artist's idea or mentality, which is much more of the sort of Eurocentric, male-dominated art world that we see. I was interested in the textile art world from sort of more of a fine art perspective, and I was doing community arts-based projects, art education, large public sculptures. So I was still trying to figure out how I could fuse my love of textiles and fine art with a kind of socially aware approach. And when I was in college, I had the opportunity to go visit Cambodia for the first time with a family friend. And she wanted to start a business there, supporting a group of women that she had met through a nonprofit hospital. And so I was able to go with her to Cambodia. And during that time, I met a number of artisans who were trying to produce products in a fair trade manner. And some of them were fair trade certified, some not. But it was my first time actually encountering sort of the fair trade movement as it pertained to textiles and fashion. And I was really inspired that, hey, there's this way to actually, you know, do something positive that's in fashion that I love, that's also going to be contributing to a good cause and not to the sort of the larger negative impact of the fashion industry. And so at that time, yeah, I was really inspired by that. And I applied for a Fulbright grant to go back to Cambodia to do more research and work with these artisans. And I was able to spend a year working with artisans in Cambodia, both doing sort of consultation on design for them and also learning from them and learning about their traditional techniques, but also how their businesses were running and working. And that was pretty much my entry into that field. And I think to go back to your original question, you know, why do I consider myself an artist? It's interesting because people will often say, oh, how did you get into running a business from being an artist? And I think that they're really very similar outlooks on life, actually, because both art and entrepreneurship are a way about solving old problems. So both art and entrepreneurship are a way of addressing old problems with new solutions. And artists have to think outside the box in the similar way that entrepreneurs do. And we're taught to come up with solutions to things where there are no obvious answers, where there's not an easy right or wrong. And I think having that training and having that creative thinking helped me in my path to entrepreneurship.
Well, I think you're so right. I mean, I feel like business building is a creative process as well. And oftentimes that sort of creative mind is, you know, and the ability to look at things differently is the only way that new solutions come to be. One thing, though, I want to ask you about, like going like way back before you even went to college, you said that you always had a social justice kind of mindset. I mean, you were aware of the negativity of the fashion industry even at a young age. I'm curious where that came from, because so many of us grow up and, you know, don't really realize what's going on behind the scenes with bigger businesses or things that are just everyday parts of our lives. How did you know about that stuff at such a young age?
I mean, I think my knowledge was pretty cursory in terms of, okay, there's sweatshops overseas, this kind of thing, you know, and that there are these exploitative labor practices. I don't think I knew about it in depth, but I knew that it existed. And my parents, I will say to my parents' credit, that they instilled some of these values in me. And from a young age, they were taking me on volunteer trips and we would do community service together. And even within the US, I was exposed to the great sort of divide between the wealthy and the poor in our country and how extreme poverty can be even in the US. And I think that I have to thank my parents for that, for kind of, you know, showing me the inequality that exists in our own country and then also internationally. And I think that once you start thinking about that and realizing that people are born into very different situations, and, you know, we have this idea in America that anyone can earn their way to great success. And that's just simply very much not true for everyone in our society, because we're not given equal opportunities. And I think that when you see that in your own country, it's a sort of a logical next step to think, well, how are the products that I'm buying also exploiting people in other places in similar ways? So yeah, I think I had started thinking about that in high school, though it was very much on a sort of, well, I'm just going to make my own clothes and be, you know, I kind of got into the sort of like DIY punk rock thing a little bit, and that movement as well. I think there's a strong component of like, make your own thing, you know, carve your own path. And that also influenced my thinking.
So you saw the disparity in different socioeconomic situations in the US. You were sort of aware of how that translated overseas and abroad, or it was a bigger issue than just right at home. Where do you think your entrepreneurial spirit came from? Were either of your parents entrepreneurs, or did you have anyone close to you growing up that had that background?
I think not traditionally in terms of starting a business, but both of my parents are very creative as well in their own different ways. So my mom, you know, had started a small cake making business when, you know, never having any training in baking, but just loving it, and started making wedding cakes for people. And that kind of grew by word of mouth. My dad was also, he's an engineer by trade, but he's a sculptor on the side, and also picked up some blacksmithing and a number of other hobbies. So I think there were those creative outlets in my life that I had as examples around me. And I think just being an artist by nature, you sort of think about, well, how can I sell this? What can I do with this thing, you know, and how can I get it to a broader audience? And as an artist, the ways that you do that might not necessarily be so conventional. You know, if you're a lawyer, if you're a doctor, there are traditional conventional paths for you. But as an artist, you need to convince other people why your work is valuable. And that's hard, because not everyone thinks that art is valuable. So you start to think, you know, you start to learn to think outside the box. And so I think that just that naturally sort of evolves into an entrepreneurial mindset.
Okay. I always love asking people about their parents and stuff, because I have kids and I'm always curious how it's going to, you know, filter down like what it is the parent does and how that translates into, you know, what people grow up to be and what they grow up to be aware of. So thank you for sharing that. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about what happened after your Fulbright experience, because from what I understand, you were there for a year. Did you stay there after that, or did you come back to the US and then return to Cambodia to live?
Yeah. So while I was on the Fulbright, so I was working with a number of artists and groups, as I mentioned, and one of the groups that I started working with was this group of women through a hospital who were all patients at a clinic there who had a hard time getting work for a number of different reasons. And during my Fulbright period, my intention was to help them start a business and then basically hand it over to them and run it, let them run it. And that was very unrealistic, which I realized later. But in discussions with this group of women, you know, I had this idea. And also it was partially because there were these social workers at the hospital who were trying to help these women get on their feet. And the social workers also had the idea to let these women run and start the business. But the reality was, in talking to them, that they really just wanted a stable job. You know, they were like, we don't really want to run a business. We just want to have a good, safe job that pays us well and that we can go home at 5 p.m. and hang out with our kids and, you know, not worry about it and stress about it. So after, you know, having a number of talks with them about what it was going to take to actually run this business and do this handover, they were sort of like, well, can you just stay in Cambodia and help us, you know, continue this? And I thought a lot about it and felt like, yeah, okay, this is maybe this is something I can continue doing, that I could keep on, you know, using what I love doing and what I'm passionate about, and also something that will be positive. So it sort of evolved from that. So it wasn't something that I had set out to said, oh, I'm going to, you know, start this business, but it truly went through a lot of evolution.
Well, it sounds like it found you. I mean, and just so people listening who may not be aware of exactly what the Fulbright is, can you tell us, I mean, you pitched this project and you get accepted and they help fund you so you can go do it. But in your mind from the beginning, was it always going to be something that had a finite kind of start and finish to it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Fulbright is actually a research grant. So you don't use it to start a business. You use it to go and learn. And it is a program that helps to promote cultural understanding. That's the main goal of the Fulbright, to basically send people from the US all over the world to try to understand the world better and come back to the US and bring those values and bring what they learned, you know, as a form of cultural exchange. So it is not about, okay, I'm going to go to this country and start something. And during my year, you know, I did a number of different things. I worked with a number of artisans. You know, I would basically essentially trade them consulting for learning from them. I would say, you know, hey, I'd love to come and work with you a little bit, learn about what you're doing. And also at the same time, I'll help you design something new if you want, you know, something along those lines. So it was an exchange with those groups. And so some of the groups I was working with were much more established. And at the same time, one of the projects I took on during that time was to work with this group of women who had not started a business yet, but were. It was a collaborative effort between me and them and also the social workers at the hospital who wanted to help start this business for this group of specific women who had been through specific hardships. And so that evolved into me basically kind of, it was my initiative from the beginning, but I intended to hand it over to them. And that evolved into me basically kind of taking it on as my own project.
Okay. So what about the experience of going to live in a different country and being fairly young and deciding that you're going to end up staying there for what turned out to be, did you stay for 6 years?
6 years, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, and not recently anymore, listeners are going to get sick of hearing me say that because they know that it's been like a year. But I mean, when you move really far away from where you've been living for a long time, it's a big deal. And I'm curious how that was for you to say, I'm going to start putting down roots in Cambodia after having grown up elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of things in life, it's not something that I set out to do from the first place. You know, I said, I'm going to go to Cambodia for a year, and then that turned into 2 years and then three. And I didn't really, you know, have this grand vision. I think people have this idea about entrepreneurship that entrepreneurs have this brilliant idea and they have a 10-year plan and they know what's going to happen. And I mean, really, that's very rare. I think that for me, it started out with, you know, you start small and you try to build something and you do what you can with what's right in front of you and the tools that you have. And then if that works, you take the next step and the next step. And then that's kind of how I saw it when I was in that process. So leaving the US and going to Cambodia, I had done a bunch of international travel before. I had lived in Albania for a summer when I was in high school. Again, going back to thank you to my parents for, you know, exposing me to different things. I had done some volunteer trips in Nicaragua and Jamaica as well. So I had had some experience overseas, but this was certainly the first time that I was going to be living in a foreign country for a year. And it didn't seem too daunting to me at the time because I thought, oh, okay, I've done this. I can do it again. But it's the things that, honestly, the things that are actually the hardest are, I think you're always surprised by them. And what you think is not going to be hard, you know, what you're prepared for is not going to be as hard because you're prepared for it. And it's what you're not prepared for and what you don't imagine, what you don't think about that actually become, I think, some of the hardest things.
Can you give me an example of one of those things that you weren't prepared for that was a challenge for you?
Yeah, I think that, so for example, so being a foreigner in a place like Cambodia, you are never really going to assimilate into that culture. And you're always going to stick out. You're always going to be white. You look like the colonialists. In many cases, the white people do act like colonialists still today. And there's a bit of a dynamic of that, which is really hard to, I think, wrap your head around. And then how you handle that. A lot of the NGOs and nonprofit organizations that have come in do sort of perpetrate this white savior, neo-colonialist values where they come and try to fix everything. And in a lot of cases, they create more harm than good. And I think, and that was really hard to sort of within that whole framework, where do you find your place in that? And how much do you impose your values on people in a country that is not your own? So, yeah, I guess, for example, the way that women are treated, it can be very difficult to swallow and watch. But at the same time, I think that, you know, so for example, like prostitution is very common, but the issues around prostitution and sex work in Cambodia are very complex, and it's easy to try to oversimplify why those things are happening. And I think if you go in with an attitude of trying to fix things and put your own values, you know, to the table first before listening, you can cause more harm than good. And at the same time, you know, learning how to sit back and listen and try to not get involved can also be really hard because you see difficult things happening in front of you. And the instinct is, oh, I need to fix this. I need to do something. But in many cases, it's not your time and place to do that. So I think that sort of challenge within myself was a huge inner conflict, especially in the first year.
Wow. Okay. Thank you for bringing that into the conversation. I mean, that does sound really difficult to grapple with, but at the same time, I'm glad that you mentioned it because I think it is so much of a big part of a lot of the issues that surround, you know, especially in the fashion industry where so much of the production often occurs in countries where the customs and the norms and family structures and all that stuff is really different from what we experience day to day.
Yeah. So I think like, I'll just give you like a pretty concrete example of that. You know, there's a lot of organizations that go to Cambodia and these are kind of nonprofit organizations and they say, okay, we're going to save a girl and from sex work and we're going to employ her sewing things instead. And so if you buy this bag, then you're basically saving a girl from sex slavery. And that's an example of a huge oversimplification because in a lot of cases, people go into sex work by choice because it's the only economic viable option for them or it's the best economic option for them. And so if you don't first understand that, then you're going to be addressing the wrong problem. If you take a girl out of a brothel and you cut off her livelihood, then you have not fixed the underlying problem. And so I think you have to really think before you do these things and also ask questions and listen and learn. And that's hard because when you see difficult things happening in front of you, you want to fix it, but you might not know the best way to fix it.
Well, so speaking of the best way to fix things and approach things and to execute things, when it came to building your brand, assuming there are many different ways you could have gone about it, and you've chosen one that's very time consuming and difficult to do and has a lot of moving parts, which is, you know, making sure that the designs are going to be marketable, but also that you're taking care of the waste part of the equation as well. You know, why not go an easier route and say, just have a clothing line that was made ethically and with, you know, possibly sustainable materials of some kind? What was the zero waste piece of this to you, and why did it become so integral to the company?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I will start by saying that we've gone through a lot of evolution. And again, kind of going back to what I was saying earlier, I didn't set out to say, okay, I'm going to create a zero waste company 8 years ago. At first, I just wanted to employ a few women that I had met who I was personally connected with and try to provide them with a stable job and income. And that was my first goal. And then for the first, you know, year and some change, that's basically what I tried to do and what I tried to make successful. And we started out with a couple of stores in Cambodia, and we were just selling there to retail customers, mostly tourists and foreigners who were traveling through. And we kind of grew up from there. So we've gone through a lot of changes. But from the beginning, I also, from a conscious perspective, I always felt it needed to be environmentally sustainable at the same time, because I think that environmental justice and social justice go hand in hand. Because in a lot of places, when we talk about climate change, when we talk about rivers being polluted and airways being polluted, this is something that directly impacts people's lives. And, you know, farmers are struggling all over the world because of the impacts of climate change right now. So I don't think that those two issues are really separable. And so I was looking for, at the time when I started the company, I was looking for the most environmentally friendly materials I could find in Cambodia. And what I found was that there was very few raw materials that were produced in Cambodia that were organic or natural. And that's partially because there's few raw materials produced there in general. Cambodia actually imports most of its fabrics for the garment factories. So then at the same time, I started to discover this problem with waste in the garment industry. I was going to these markets, and I started finding these piles of fabric, and I would ask the sellers, oh, where does this come from? And they would tell me that it came from the factories. And sometimes you would even find piles of half-finished t-shirts and scraps that were obviously cut in the factories. They could see that pieces were cut out of them. And so that's how I kind of learned about that. And then I realized that using these offcuts was also a good way to basically get somewhat consistent supplies of fabric, because we had been using secondhand materials like bed sheets and shirts and things like that. But that was very hard to standardize. It was hard to get a consistent look across our products. With the remnant fabrics, we were able to start to get a little more consistency. Okay, we always know they're going to be making, you know, Gap is always going to be making black t-shirts. So there's always going to be black. There's always going to be navy. There's always going to be gray. So we sort of work with basic colors that we know we can always find. And then the zero waste approach really came later, because we started using these remnant materials and we found, oh, we still have scraps of our own left. And so how can we use this piece? How can we use that piece? And through each collection to collection, we would have more leftover fabrics of certain types. So we would try to figure out how to use them. And gradually, as we designed more products around these scraps, we were able to get down to almost no waste. And at that point I said, well, we have like 1% waste left. So what can we do with this? Let's make paper out of it. And that's where we were able to close the loop.
So one thing I've noticed about the products that you sell, at least online, that the ones that you can see, there are so many things about them that seem like they required a lot of, you know, hands-on work, obviously, but that the process itself was just extremely detailed and intricate. And I'm wondering if that, I mean, you kind of alluded to using the certain colors because that works well with your process and you can have the consistency. But what about the design itself? I mean, how do you balance the work that goes into these because of your commitment to sustainability and zero waste at this point? And, you know, being able to do it in a way that creates designs that are things people want to wear, but also priced at a reasonable place. And I mean, I just am thinking as I'm saying this of companies that I know of that they sell beautiful, ethically made, like sustainable garments, but they're so expensive and yours are actually quite reasonable. So I'm wondering how that affects your design and your approach to design.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, from the beginning for me, it was always important. It was a priority to make these clothes affordable, because I do think that there are some really amazing things out there that are beautifully made and they're expensive. And part of the reason that stuff is more expensive is because they actually, you know, a lot of times the fashion brands, they do try to push it to a luxury level because it's going to be easier for them to sell the products as luxury products. And they'll, you know, they'll definitely add details and finishing and fabrics that make it more luxury. So it's a justifiable price. But we really wanted to keep our stuff affordable. And that's always a balancing act, because we can't make it cheap. But we also want to keep it so that it's like, if you're willing to spend $38 on a t-shirt at Urban Outfitters, then in my opinion, you should be willing to spend $38 on an ethically made t-shirt. So that's kind of how we want to frame it, where it's like, if you can afford to shop here, then you can afford to shop in Urban Outfitters, then you can buy from Tonley. But that's been hard, because it is a balancing act with the design and the materials. And, you know, sometimes we want to do a certain kind of design, but then we make the sample and it's like, well, this is going to be way too expensive for what people are willing to pay for this item. So when we do design things, it's not only, I mean, this is the interesting thing about zero waste. It's not just about being able to design something that's made out of scraps, because lots of people can do that. But the question is really, can you design something that's made out of scraps that people will pay for this price, for X price? And that's a question that we have to address during the design process, because, you know, I don't want to go through sampling and everything on something that's going to end up being too expensive to sell into our target market. But some other ways that we've been able to keep the cost down is that, you know, our materials are actually fairly cheap because they are remnant materials. What's expensive is the labor that goes into, you know, like, for example, our handwoven pieces. Every single strip is cut by hand, stitched together into yarn, and then rewoven into new fabrics. And then those fabrics have to still be sewn into the garments. So most of the cost is in the labor, which is great because that basically allows us to pay, you know, our staff in Cambodia more money rather than putting that money towards expensive materials.
And do they all have to be trained on your methods specifically, or are a lot of them coming in with the skills they need to make these garments?
We have to do a fair amount of training. And also what's a little bit different about our workshop is that we do not have, you know, a typical assembly line model where you come in and you learn only one process and you do that every day, all the time. All of our staff actually can work on a number of different processes. They can move around through the workshop to different jobs. They're not just stuck doing the same thing over and over again. So working that way means that they are going to require more training. But what we do, we have a per piece rate that people are paid for items. But if they want to train on a new subject, we also will pay them while they're in training. And so they can have the opportunity to basically learn lots of different skills and move up in the company as well.
And I love how on your site you actually show who worked on what garment by name.
Yeah, it's a, you know, we really want to try to cultivate this idea that there are real people working on the products that you buy. And I think if you have been to a factory in, you know, overseas, I think most Americans, at least when I was growing up, I had this idea that, or when I was younger, I had this idea that a factory is a place where you just throw in some materials and a bunch of, you know, it goes through a bunch of pipes and machines and on the other end a t-shirt comes out and someone pushes a button. And actually, you know, most garments today are very manually made. I mean, when you say the word, you know, when a fair trade company says the word handmade, it doesn't necessarily mean machines weren't involved, but it acknowledges the fact that humans really operate these machines, that people are touching your garment, you know, and are actually making this and involved in a very manual way. And that's still true in the factories. I mean, the factories are, they're still extremely hands-on. So I think getting the idea that a real person sat behind a sewing machine and created every single stitch on your garment, if you can imagine that and you can understand that, I think you'd be less likely to participate in exploiting that person.
Okay, so from the business standpoint, we have a lot of people in the audience who listen to this show regularly and they're in the midst of trying to build their own brand that has products that are either sustainable or made in some sort of innovative and ethical way. Now, I feel like it's a fairly challenging road to go down, as much as I want to tell people to go down it all the time. With your point of view and your perspective 8 years into this and looking back, I mean, what do you think that they should know at the beginning? What do you wish they were heading out into the world with that would help them pull this off?
Sure. So I think my path was a little unconventional in that I actually built, you know, basically my own production and all of my team are on our payroll. So whether or not we get orders, we still have to pay, you know, almost about 50 people a month. And we have 25 or so independent weavers that also are getting a lot of business from us and that somewhat depend on us. And so that's a lot of responsibility. And it also took a lot of time and hard work. And I think that that is not something that everyone needs to tackle, because there are a lot of great businesses out there like us and like others who are already doing that, that you can tap into as a resource for getting your production done. I think it takes a bit of research to find the right producers in terms of, you know, the ethics that you want. And I think it's really important to go to visit them, because what you see on paper is not always what is actually happening. And I think that educating yourself on some basic guidelines about factory safety and what you should be looking for, what, you know, what a workshop or a factory should look like, so you know how to ask the right questions before you go and visit those people. I think, you know, do your vetting, do, you know, check everything before you go ahead. But I do think that finding the right production partner is probably one of the most important things in setting up something like this. And then I think my second piece of advice would be that learning from other people who are already doing this before you jump into starting something. I mean, I had the opportunity to do that under my Fulbright grant and work with a number of brands, but I meet a lot of young designers who contact me and say, oh, I'm trying to set up this business. I'm trying to do that, this and that. And what they really want to do is the creative aspects. And I don't think that they fully grasp how much other stuff there is involved in running a business like this. So ask yourself, you know, which parts do you really want to be doing? And then if there are parts that you really don't want to be doing or feel like you're not capable of doing, that you need to find the right people to help you. And I think that going and working with someone else first before you try to set out on your own is a good way to kind of understand which parts of the business you really want to be involved in and what you want to do before you, you know, really try to do your own thing.
Well, that's wonderful advice. And, you know, in thinking about going and trying to either work for somebody else or partnering with them, you know, it seems like it would be a good idea to do that maybe before you actually try to launch your own thing, because if you get into the middle of something and then trying to bring somebody in is not always the easiest thing to do.
Yeah. And I think also that there are lots of ways for you to be entrepreneurial without having to start your own business. So for example, there are a lot of great fair trade, I use the word fair trade, but I mean ethical kind of workshops overseas that would be thrilled to have a designer come and help them create a new collection. So I think there are ways to go and actually see your designs made and create a collection without having to start your own business. And if as a designer and as someone who wants to contribute to the ethical fashion industry, that could be equally fulfilling as starting your own line. I mean, it's not necessarily to always reinvent the wheel. And I think people do feel that they want to start their own brand, which is admirable, but there's a lot of people doing duplicate efforts. And I don't know if it's always necessary to do that rather than to team up with, you know, other folks and try to help them do what they're doing better.
Thank you for bringing that into the conversation. I think that's really great advice. So I always have a few questions that I ask everyone who comes on the show, and I'm excited to ask you. Are there any tech tools, apps, books, resources, or just a really great low-tech piece of advice that's helped you kick ass in your day-to-day life that you think would help listeners kick more ass in their day-to-day lives?
Two very, very small little apps that have helped me a lot. One is Boomerang, which is a little app that you can add to your Gmail, which really helps me manage my inbox. And the second is Calendly, which is a calendar tool which helps people make appointments, which I think you use to help to schedule this appointment. But I love that app because it really helps me manage my time and helps me manage my appointments with people.
I love that. I love both of those. And with Calendly, it took me a little bit to get, I don't know if this happened to you, but to get over the hump of like giving people the link and saying, here, go book a time, because I felt kind of weird, like they have to go schedule something with me. But then after I got used to it, I was like, this is saving everybody so much time. It's awesome.
No, exactly. I mean, it is a little weird, but then at the same time, it's easy. It's really easy for everyone. And then, you know, you can both pick a time that works for you. And yeah, it's fantastic.
So you and I have never hung out in person, but if we were to hang out all day, what would I end up absolutely loving about you and what would drive me insane?
Well, I'm pretty up for anything. So I love adventures. And I will probably propose to make you do some rock climbing because I have lots of passes to my gym. And anytime someone wants to hang out with me, I'm like, we should go rock climbing, even if they don't know how to rock climb. And it's always really fun. So I would make you do that, which might scare you or it might be fun.
No, I think it would be fun. I used to do rock climbing when I was a kid at summer camp. You know, I would go to like overnight camp that was really outdoorsy and I loved it. But just as an adult, I've never, you know, kind of followed up with it because I don't know anyone else who is good enough that I would trust them to actually go with me out to, you know what I mean? Like you always want to be with an expert or somebody that knows like 10 times more than you. So
yeah, totally. I mean, I like climbing in the gym climbing outdoors is a special thing, but climbing the gym is fun because it's a lot safer and it's a lot lower risk for people who are just kind of starting out or want to try it. It's pretty safe if you do that way. What would drive you crazy about me? Well, I think one of the things that probably drives a lot of my friends crazy is that I operate very in the moment. So I'm not that great at planning things in advance. And when you're there with me, I'm super attentive and really with it. And I have a very hard time planning, you know, far in advance, which is why I'm really working on my Gmail and my Calendly. But yeah, I think that does drive people a little crazy sometimes.
So are you the kind of person that if somebody's like, hey, we need to get together in the next couple of weeks, that it's hard to get you to commit to a date or something, like, you know?
Yeah, like for example, when I go to Cambodia, I usually book my trips about a week in advance, which always costs me way more money. And it's so silly, but I'm terrible. Like if someone's like, let's go on a trip in 6 months, I'm like, oh, I'll tell you in 4 months or 5 months probably. So yeah, and if someone's like, oh, let's go do this exciting thing tomorrow, I'd probably be down. So yes.
if you were to print a phrase or a motto on a zero waste t-shirt and have to wear it around for the next 7 days, what would it be?
Oh, right now, I think it would probably be something about immigration.
I know.
And how wonderful, you know, it's been a disturbing time. And it's interesting running an international company with this sort of new age of American protectionism and people wanting to move jobs back to America when they're not willing to pay for American products. I think of the world as one rather than as individual countries. And I don't understand the sort of mentality of why America is any more important than any other parts of the world.
You know, and I'm really glad that you just brought up what you said, which is it's all well and good to advocate for made in the USA production, but when you're not willing to pay for it, then it's a really hard place to have sure footing. I mean, that perspective, it's problematic. And I know that the issue of immigration and then also the idea of immigrants being blamed for a job loss here, it's extremely frustrating to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm so supportive of anyone who can, you know, viably produce their products in America. And I like to buy American made things when I can, too. I think it's great. But I do think that it's unrealistic to talk about that when you're not talking about, okay, we're talking about like quadrupling our prices if we do that. And people are already not willing to pay for ethical made fashion made in Cambodia sometimes. So it's just like, you know, we have to have a reality check that if you want to do that, then okay, your clothes are going to cost five times as much, if not more. So, and I think like I'd love to make a Made in America line at some point, but it would have to be a higher value thing. It would have to be a luxury item. And that's just the reality of it. And then, you know, you have to market it that way. You have to make it a luxury price point. And I think then you're just doing some, it's just different, you know? So I'm all about it, but I think it has to be a two-sided conversation.
No, I agree. And I mean, it's one of the reasons why I like being able to talk to people like you and to bring these issues up and have them get out there to more people. So I always close out by asking guests who come on the show, if you have a question you'd like to ask me, anything silly or serious, I promise I'll give you an honest answer.
What's your favorite piece of clothing?
Favorite piece of clothing? Well, I definitely,
and why?
I don't really have, oh God, there's no way I have one because I'm a big vintage person. I mean, I don't wear vintage in that I'm trying to have a vintage look exactly, but I love buying things that are secondhand and that have like a not, you don't see it every day kind of thing about them. I'll just tell you one thing that I love that I was so kind of on the fence about buying because I thought it was too out there, but it's been awesome. I went into this thrift store in Seattle last year and I was meeting some friends, but I got there before they did. And so I had a couple hours to kill. So I was just walking down the street and I didn't really have any destination in mind. And I went into this thrift store and it was really a secondhand vintage kind of shop. And I found this denim dress that it's completely like early 80s. It's got like a big denim belt that has like, you know, a metal buckle and it's got big shoulders and it's kind of like this sort of ridiculous looking dress. But I put it on and I was like, I love this thing. I don't know what it is about it, but it was super comfortable, has pockets. And the cut of it just, I felt like it looked right on me, even though it was straight out of 1983. And I bought it and I thought, where am I going to wear this? Well, I wear it all the time. And I just feel like it's fun when you discover something that is secondhand and older, but yet it just keeps on. Like it's completely in great shape. And it says something about how things were made, you know, many years ago. And also that you don't have to wear what's just on the rack and what people are showing you to be the current silhouettes and all that stuff of today. So
that's awesome. Yeah, I love that experience. I mean, sometimes you just a piece of clothing just calls to you. And then it's so that's one of the great things about clothes that you when you are very, you know, selective about what you put in your wardrobe, you just tend to pick out things that you really love and that love you back, you know, and give you that. And there's something really nice about that. I mean, there's something really special about that.
I think so. So if people want to stay in touch with you and hear about all the great things that you and Tonle have coming out this year, what's the best way for them to follow you online and connect with the brand?
Sure. So we're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Tonle Design. So TONLEDESIGN. And our website is tonle.com.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for making the time to chat with me today. And I hope you have a great rest of your week.
Thank you so much.
Done and done. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Rachel. I love what she said there about our funny habit of harping on American-made products, but yet being unwilling to pay the price for many of them. And I also love how she called out that there are sustainable options and ethical options out there that are equivalent to a lot of the stores that many of us consider reasonably priced, like Urban Outfitters. So, a couple things to keep in mind as you move into your spring and summer new wardrobe considering that often happens around this time of year. So yeah, in closing out, I wanted to bring in a couple of things inspired by the fact that I'm out and about at a conference this week. Shop Talk is one of those really big conferences that takes place in Las Vegas and brings people from companies all over the world. I think they have something like 330 speakers. I mean, it is a big old massive affair. And it got me thinking about the fact that going to a conference isn't something you just get value out of automatically. No, you really have to hustle and make things happen for yourself, or you can watch the entire thing go by and you wonder, well, why did I go to that exactly? I think that's even easier to do if you're an entrepreneur running your own thing or somebody in the media, because if you are going because your manager, you know, told you to go, you know what you're supposed to do there. But for those of us who have more entrepreneurial objectives where we have to kind of chart our own path at these things, I wanted to put my top two tips out in front of you in case they can help you the next time you are headed to a conference or another event. Number one, it's so simple, but anytime you are at a panel, a discussion, a meetup, anything where there's an opportunity to stand up and ask a question or make a comment, stand up and ask a question or make a comment. Now, obviously, don't just stand up and ask something that is completely unrelated to the larger conversation, or just as worse, something that is completely self-serving and doesn't add value to the conversation that's taking place. But instead, really listen to what's going on and think of what you can stand up and say or ask that will push the conversation into a helpful place for everyone in the audience. And sometimes that can be as easy as saying to the person leading, open up things for questions, pose your question in a way that gives them a chance to sound good. You know, you're not really asking the question so that they can sound good, but a lot of times if you ask things in such a way that somebody feels excited to answer your question, you're going to get a lot better information. So if you can sort of set them up to do what they do really well, I think it often leads to more chances to have a larger, you know, longer, more interesting conversation come out of it, whether it happens right there during the event or whether you get to talk to the person afterwards. So you could say something like, I'm really curious what you're seeing in da-da-da-da-da industry and how you think that's going to affect those of us who are trying to do X, Y, and Z within the next year to 2 years. You know, I mean, give them some kind of tee up and then wait for what they have to say. And what I have noticed is that when you ask the question, it's not so much about what you ask and that person answering as it is about you standing up and being seen and having a voice. And it makes it a lot easier to talk to panelists after the event, if there's an opportunity to do that, if you've already stood up and you know made their event better through your participation, it also makes it easier for people in the audience to come up and connect with you who may be interested in connecting with others who are attending a similar event to them or the same event to them. So you get what I'm saying. So stand up, say something, even if it feels awkward. And then my second tip is that if you want to connect with people, you have to connect people. So anytime you want to make your network grow, the best thing you could possibly do is to help somebody else grow their network. So be a connector. And it's funny how the more you connect other people, the more connected you become. Now, another thing that happens at conferences, oh yeah, speaking, public speaking. I was recently treated to an awesome night put on by the Charlottesville Women in Tech organization here in the town that I live in. And it was all focused on encouraging women in the tech industry to be more proactive about putting themselves out there, getting on panels, giving talks, all of that kind of good stuff. And as part of that, they brought in a speaking coach and an actress, Kate Bennis. She's a local Charlottesville resident, and she has quite an extensive track record with being on stage and then also coaching academics, entrepreneurs, community leaders, people that frequently get up and talk in front of others on how to create a killer talk, a killer speech, and polish and perfect what they're going to present on stage in front of a live audience. And she did a wonderful presentation for us. But then at the end, one of the most fun parts of the evening was that she ran through everything that we needed to know about public speaking in 10 minutes or less. And it was this amazing crash course of things that you need to keep in mind. And they went from tactical, such as don't memorize and how to get away with not memorizing. She went into that as well, to things that are more emotional. Like if a topic seems really scary, well, maybe that's something you need to look into because there's probably something really interesting there, right? Kind of gives me a little bit of the shivers thinking about that. But anyway, she went through all of these great, wonderful tips and we have pulled them together for you. They are up on the Press Dope blog right now. If you want to prep for your next speaking event, I highly recommend checking out Kate's tips. They've made a big difference in how I'm thinking about my next public speaking situation, which is coming up in April. You will find her tips available at pressdope.com/blog. So I hope you will check those out. And I hope you will join me next time for another conversation with a woman at the forefront of fashion, entrepreneurship, sustainability, and tech. As you know, I call it fast, and it's the future.